Price, and this is Price Talks. In this town, if you're interested in how to create great places and good cities and vibrant communities and economy, you're eventually going to meet someone from Happy City. Chances are you'd meet Charles Montgomery. He started it, but these days you're more likely actually to meet Hussam Ilukda. Hi, Hussam.
Hello, Gord. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How long have you been with Happy City?
I've been with Happy City, I think it's almost 5 years now.
Now, I better get, I think, a more detailed explanation of what Happy City is.
Happy City is an urban design consultancy that works at the intersection of urban planning, cities, and the science of happiness. So we try to find how to make cities happier, healthier, and more inclusive.
What is happiness?
Ooh, that is a question. But the way we look at it is it's basically a combination of feeling happy, contentment. And we're not talking about, you know, fleeting moments of pleasure, but long-term sustained happiness.
Yeah, drugs can still do that too.
Yeah. And we're also talking about, you know, a state of thriving. You know, Carol Rift, the psychologist, really calls it that. It's a state of feeling like you are living up to your own potential. And then it's a combination of also, you know, healthy life years. So within the three of those is where we really identify our definition of happiness.
That's where it slips into something spiritual.
Perhaps. Not always. It's more about a sense of meaning, sense of belonging, feeling like you are living towards something.
I don't mean to be facetious about it, but I was thinking alcohol and drugs and, mm-hmm. Yeah, even fundamentalist religions of certain kind can offer you what seems to be a genuine feeling of contentment. And if you do it continually, it may not be good for you, but you can maintain the illusion.
I think it's more about the sense of purpose. And that's where the illusion of things like religion and even fundamentalism and nationalism come in, that you are living, accomplishing something that's bigger than yourself. It doesn't need to just be, you know, things like that. We think that, and from the research that we're finding, is that happiness has more to do with, you know, your day-to-day experiences and interactions with people, your social relationships, your relationships with family and friends, but even broader relationships and kind of more more casual and shallow relationships, like your relationships with your grocer, your butcher, saying hello to a neighbor, or even just meeting eye to eye and sharing a smile with a complete stranger, that these things have a more powerful impact on our happiness than almost anything.
So you help design that.
What we try to do is we try to make social interaction, healthy, active lifestyle, the kind of community living that promotes this feeling of happiness. We try to make it the default
in cities.
I don't
know who that is, though. What do you do?
Well, we work with cities, we work with developers, anyone who has any kind of influence on the way cities are designed in the physical environment, from its connection with transportation systems to architects and park design. And we try to bring this happiness, evidence-based happiness framework, and look at the design from the purpose, you know, not on the specific design elements, but on the higher level principles. What are we trying to achieve? What matters most to us? And often when the conversation starts there, the design follows to the principles that we set.
So you're the happy generalists who are giving a frame to the technicians.
Not necessarily. We start at the high level, and then sometimes our role stops there. Sometimes our role stops at the education piece of making sure that people understand these relationships, understand where the urban design decisions that they're making are going. And in most times, in most of our project work, we are helping people get there.
All right.
We are also implementing it with them.
Before we get there,
yes,
I want to know more about you.
Of course.
Where are you from?
I grew up in Cairo, and then I moved to Halifax, which is really a study of contrasts. Couldn't have picked something more different in terms of weather, size, lifestyle, everything.
All right, two personal things. May I ask how old you are?
I am 26 years old.
Oh, goodness. And when did you come to Canada?
I moved to Canada about 12 years ago.
So you were basically a teenager.
I was.
Growing up in Cairo.
Yes.
Tell us more. What's that like?
Oof. I mean, the lingering memory that I have in, from Cairo and the feeling that I get every time I go back there is being stuck in traffic. Chaos and stress. I love this city to death, but if I go there for more than, you know, a week or two at a time, it starts getting to me, starts changing me, changing how I interact with my friends, with my family, and I feel it. And in the essence, my experiences in Cairo, both the positive and the negative, are what motivated me and drew me closer to Happy City and to try and understand the deeper emotional impacts of urban design.
There must have been some direct connection. Was it through studies? Did you go to Halifax for university?
Yeah, I did go to did my undergrad in Halifax, and that is actually where I met Charles Montgomery, who is the author of the book Happy City, the founder of the company Happy City. The funny story is I read his book and immediately harassed him incessantly and told him I want to do what I'm, this is what urban planning is for me. This is, you know, this this is my purpose as an urban planner. I want to make cities and people in cities happier, healthier. And he was coming to Halifax. So I did some research for him, showed him around the city, introduced him to all the planners there, and we stayed in touch, and eventually I was working with him.
This was meant to be.
It was fate. It happened.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Tell me about your neighborhood.
My current neighborhood?
No, the one you grew up in.
I grew up in a neighborhood called Heliopolis, which is, it's one of the streetcar suburbs of Cairo. It was actually built maybe just over 120 years ago. And the interesting part about this is that it was designed by, I think, this French architect or planner. And what he did is his vision was, we're going to build streetcar lines in the middle of the desert. People were kind of calling him crazy. Today, if you go to Heliopolis, you wouldn't know it. You wouldn't know that, you know, it had such a short history, but it did. I mean, in its urban form. And now it's just an incredibly vibrant, diverse neighborhood with different levels of income, different kinds of commercial activities, education. I mean, Cairo as a whole has a lot of problems. Heliopolis is it's one of my favorite places in the city, remains to be.
You go out your front door, first of all, was it an apartment building, a house?
Most Egyptians, most residents of Cairo, up until maybe the last 15 years, live in apartments. The single family house is an export that we have never been familiar with until the last 15 years when they started building golf courses in the deserts and trying to pretend like they're North American.
Sam, are you telling me that it's possible to raise a kid in an apartment building?
Oh, well.
Here you are.
Here I am.
How many in your family?
There's just four of us. So my parents and I have one brother.
What was sharing space like?
Well, the family dynamics in Egypt are really interesting because families tend to congregate together. So here in Vancouver, you have the co-housing model where friends, sometimes strangers, come together and decide to live together and share common amenities. Egyptians have been, and Arabs in general, have been doing that for decades, but it's with families. And families and extended families live together. So we lived in a four-story building where my grandparents had the ground floor, and each of the other floors was one of my uncles. And we had a small little kind of a shared park that was only common space only for us. And my grandfather's house had like an, his apartment was a little bit bigger than everyone else, and it had a bigger kind of guest space where we, when we would throw big parties, that is where we would host it at my grandfather's home. And I grew up, I would say I am closer to my cousin than I am to my actual brother, because we were close in age and we lived one floor above each other.
Did the family jointly share in the ownership of it?
No, each person had the ownership of their individual units. My father is an architect, so he actually designed the building. So in this case, it was kind of shared, but in most cases, it's not always.
An apartment building that was an extended family.
Yeah, apartment buildings and extended families. This is how a lot of Egyptians live today.
Four stories, sharing space. No, this is sounding like the missing middle we always hear about in Vancouver.
Yes, of course, yeah.
We think of co-housing or shared housing or co-ops as kind of 1960s, 70s hippie-ish. You're telling me it's Egyptian.
I think the living with the extended family, it's not something that's just in Egypt. It's in a lot of the Arab world, and it is in certain parts of Asia, even in earlier.
It's the Vancouver special.
Vancouver special.
That's right.
I'm still learning what the Vancouver special is.
A very important part of our
getting
design
getting
history.
To know the local lingo.
Well, let's continue on. You go outside your building. What do you see?
You go outside my building. Actually, our entrance is on a shared alleyway, so it's not directly on the street where the cars go around. It's on a shared alleyway where I and my cousins would play soccer, would just hang out. Away from the street, and it broke up the block, and it was shared between maybe four other buildings that also fronted this same alleyway that was not your typical, you know, dingy alleyway that you may see here in Vancouver. It was quite well, well lit, had a lot of greenery.
This was
good
safe
material.
Space.
It was very safe space, and I remember my parents would tell me, do not get out of the alleyway close to the street. And that is all the direction they had to give me. They knew that the people, that were looking after the other buildings would keep an eye on us. My mother would always just look out of the window and check and see that we were still there. It was quite liberating, actually. And nowadays, unfortunately, it's quite different in Cairo.
But before we go there, let's take you out onto the street. You leave your alley. What do you see?
And then you go into more typical streets. The residential streets tend to be narrower. They would actually quite similar to a lot of the streets here in Vancouver.
Classic chain, 66 feet. Kitsilano, West End
yeah,
Street.
Yeah, yeah. Like parking on both sides, pretty narrow street. If the flow gets a little high, it gets pretty clogged up, so people try to avoid it. But we also, on the street, we had the local mosque. In almost every one or two blocks, you would find the little corner mosque that would just be for these people. And then you go a bit higher on the four or five block level, there's a bigger mosque. And then on a neighborhood level, there's a bigger mosque. And there's always like one big mosque that brings everyone together.
I think, interestingly, the Mormons have a similar kind of structure.
I don't know about that.
So you have a corner mosque. Do you have a corner store?
Yes. And they're usually close together. And around some of the bigger mosques, there's always marketplaces. Because, Muslims, a lot of them at least would go once a week. The more devoted ones would actually go to the mosque five times a day. So this is natural activity, and the people, the vendors, figure this out and they locate where people go.
So you can do basically all your day-to-day shopping, that is what you need for dinner, food.
Yep.
Pretty much the same block.
Yep, pretty much within walking distance, always.
What would be your next destination beyond that?
Growing up in Egypt, it was cool. And this is where it gets interesting, because here in Canada, the school system is it's all about the local school systems, right? So primary schools tend to be really close, secondary schools a bit further, et cetera, et cetera. In Egypt, the public school system is quite awful. It is really bad. So if you wanted a decent education, you would go to a bigger private schools that tended to take the whole spectrum of it. So at some point, the Egyptian government decided that they're going to put all the major public, the major private schools, the good ones, out in one of the new desert suburbs. So my commute to school was every day about an hour and a half in traffic each way.
That did not make you happy.
No.
Huh.
It did not.
How would you get there?
By school bus, or a lot of times carpooled, and sometimes I would be driven there by parents or others.
For other destinations around the city, car, bus? What happened to the streetcar?
The streetcars suffered from like decades of underinvestment, and now they're slow. The initial network didn't expand, even though the neighborhood itself did and the city did. So they don't get you to as many destinations as you want. And the quality went down so bad that it just became unsafe, overcrowded sometimes in other places. The public transit system in Egypt is quite chaotic. I would say very unsafe, especially
for
women.
So people want to get cars.
People want to get cars, but most can't afford cars.
Then what?
So, you know, if you can't afford a car, then you will take public transit. It is mostly informal transit. I would say close to 2/3 of the public transit trips are on paratransit, we call it, which is, you know, microbuses, minibuses, 10, 12 people. Sometimes you see people like riding on pickup trucks and all kinds of creative ways to get to where they're going.
Did you or your family have a car?
We had a car, and that's, you know, my parents never felt it was safe enough for them to feel confident to let us take public transit.
Where did they park it?
We had a garage in our home, underground.
This was unusual.
It was unusual, but...
Did you want a car when you were old enough?
Yes, in both... In Cairo, so I have to have a car when I'm in Cairo, and then when I moved to Halifax, my parents also decided to live in the suburbs, so I needed a car. It wasn't until I left my parents' home, moved to more walkable urban core, and decided that I could live in other ways.
Let's go back to that Halifax suburban experience. Yeah. You went directly from Cairo one day and you ended up in the Canadian dream on the next.
Yes, absolutely.
Big front lawn?
Big front lawn, big backyard, your typical suburban life. I did a couple of years of high school, and I even though I wouldn't say it was very far, but my mother would still drive me to school, as many other mothers did. Quickly, my mother, you know, I saw her start to, you know, have this extra role as a chauffeur, where she has to give up her time to get me to access all the opportunities that a kid should access.
But I'm wondering, when you went from the airport to this new house, mm-hmm. in this new world.
Yes.
What was your immediate reaction?
Well, it wasn't a direct transition. There was an intermediary part in the middle where we lived in a very bad apartment building. I mean, this is what we saw in movies. This was the American dream, right? I guess it was a Canadian dream, but...
Australian dream, it's pretty universal.
Yeah, my father was excited. He wanted to have his big lawn. He was so excited about having the big garden. He built up a deck. He was so excited by it, but it, you know.
Nothing quite says status like a big front lawn.
Of course.
Now, I get the sense, though, you were, if not neutral, maybe...
I was quite neutral. I never enjoyed driving myself, never enjoyed being driven, always wanted to find something else.
Did you have your own room, though?
I did have my own room.
Hey,
but most
the school was close and good? Come on, dude. Oh, what's wrong?
That's good. But most of all was the sense of isolation that I felt in the suburbs. If I wanted to see my friends, even if they lived nearby, the only place to meet was in our own homes. There was no way to no place to really go and hang out. If you wanted to have coffee, the only options nearby for me were either Starbucks or McDonald's, if you consider that coffee.
Well, even as a teenager then, were you already used to the street life of Cairo and, that experience of living in the street?
I was relatively more used to it than the Canadians, I would say. mostly I was used to the vibrant street life, the activity, people around in the street day and night. Egyptians are the most social people you might ever meet. And we meet on porches, we meet on the street, we meet on coffee shops. We spent hours just sharing laughs. This is the quintessential Egyptian experience. And that was almost immediately gone when I moved here.
And that's what you went looking for?
That is what I went looking for.
Did you find anything like it?
I found forms of it in different ways. A lot of it were still with Egyptian communities that were accustomed to building the same strong relationships, and living long enough in Halifax, you can build that. But I did build these, I want to call them tribes, with people who are not Egyptian, given the right time and the opportunities to meet the same people over and over again in, repeated times and limited spaces. You build relationships, you become friends, and then it's like your brothers and sisters.
So Houssam's Halifax tribe?
Yes.
What would you do? What would the tribe do?
Honestly, mostly we did nothing, but we did nothing together. And that was the best part of it. I just moved to Vancouver, so I am discovering the social life of Vancouver, and it is different than what I am used to in Halifax, what I am used to in Egypt. I have never made a social plan 2 weeks in advance. It baffles me, because I finish work, I am tired. What I am used to do is to call, text, whatever, my friends, and say, hey, what's everyone doing? And then everyone say, nothing. Okay, I'm gonna come. And we hang out. We watch TV. We go out to eat. We cook together. We do whatever we want, or we do nothing, but we're doing it together.
Can't you find tribal members here?
I think I can, and I'm trying to build that, but it feels like an effortful process. I'm intentionally building it because I know that that's what I need.
Anyone who looks from the outside, your standard Anglo-Canadian, and says, I want to be part of that tribe. Do you get people who say, that way of life, your way of life?
I think the vast majority of people resonate with that, want to feel like they are part of a group of friends that care for each other, that love each other, that support each other, and ones that they can just be themselves with. And I think that urban design and the way that our cities are designed have a major role to play in that.
Really?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's test this.
Let's test it.
All right. Give me a good example that brings people together in the way that you're talking about, where you can actually see the connection.
I will give you a good example. So the scale of Halifax is... It's not a big city, but it's not a small city. And there are just enough, population to sustain businesses and economies and have a main street, etc.
How many?
It's about 400,000 people, right? But it is small enough that when I walk down the main street, Spring Garden Road in Halifax, chances are I will meet someone I know. I will give you an example. In one of the events, you'd meet people once. You know, you walk in, you go to an event, you meet someone who might be remotely similar interests to you, and you introduce yourselves, and you know each other's name. And then you're walking down the street, you meet the same person again, you say hello. You are going to run an errand, you meet the same person again, because the scale of the city, the abundance of, you know, public spaces, commercial spaces, things that get you out of the house, give you space to meet people, you end up eventually having longer and longer conversations with them.
I can do that, a lot of it, at a shopping mall.
You can, but...
A classic 1950s...
Sure.
Maybe it's been rebuilt to have a little Main Street.
But where is it?
Park Royal?
Are you gonna build a shopping mall at the neighborhood level on every neighborhood?
Kind of version of it.
You can build a, every neighborhood can have a little Main Street. That's one thing. And every neighborhood can have, you know, the kind of place where people can just casually go. But is it that, I mean, your definition of shopping mall can be like the interior inside right. place that.
Well, you know, what I'm really wondering is how significant is a sense of nostalgia, of building on a foundation of the past.
Mm-hmm.
If I could reproduce much of what you're talking about, is that good enough? Or does it actually have to have some history that you can go back a generation or two to have those connections among people that creates that vibrancy, that provides support for those uses?
I think it's just a matter of opportunity, the opportunity to meet people, the chance encounters and how likely it is to happen over and over again.
So you tell one of your clients,
mm-hmm.
that's what you're aiming for, you work with the designers.
Yes.
Have you had some successes and some failures?
Well, I would say it's a matter of creating these transitionary spaces where people feel like they can control their sense of interaction. Gradually moving from the privacy of your own home to the public nature of the street. The more intermediary spaces you have between that, where you can just sit and do nothing and not look like the weirdo hanging out in a corridor, then the more likely that people will meet. I'll tell you a really interesting story. In one event, Charles and I were speaking to a group of people about the architecture of loneliness and how buildings can influence our social relationships. And after that, someone came up to us and he told me, "Let me tell you about the happiest time of my life, the happiest place that I ever lived in." My mind automatically went to, like, you know, maybe he lived in a small town, maybe he lived in the kind of place that, you know, where you would just know everyone in your community and have strong relationships. But he said it was when he was living in a tower in Toronto. Now, I don't know about you, but happy social life connecting with your neighbor does not strike an image of a Toronto tower to me. So I probed him more. Why? Like, tell me. And what he said was, you know, first of all, the building itself had a diversity of units. So from single one-bedroom units to three-bedroom units, so it allowed for families to exist. On his floor, the corridors were actually wide enough that the residents can hang out in the corridor and have their own, like, little nooks in front of their doors and put up, like, a couple of chairs without, like, you know, being a fire hazard or or impeding people moving. And kids, because the corridors were so big, the kids would go out and actually play in the corridors. And you know, when they got too unruly, the neighbors would just tell them to quiet down. But the kids made friends together, their parents made friends together, and before you know it, what he was saying was a regular occurrence in this building was that people would bring out their tables in the corridors and have potlucks together. It sounds like a fantasy. I want to see it from my own eyes. I still haven't, but...
I live in a 9-story tower. I'm on the second floor. The building is 1958. I live in the West End. I've been a politician.
Yeah.
Community activist. And the conclusion I've come to is if people can stay in the same place for long enough to establish connections, the architecture and the design doesn't matter as much as we think it does.
I think it plays a role. So one of the projects that Happy City has done in the last few years is the Happy Homes Project, which is a collaboration between Happy City with support from BC Housing and the Real Estate Foundation to investigate all the evidence behind how social relationships form in multi-family buildings. And tenure, the length of tenure, was a big component of it. You stay still for enough time and you form relationships. But there are various other factors that can influence it as well. And things like, you know, as I mentioned, the transitionary spaces, even walkability plays a role in the strength of the relationships that people build. Because if you are getting out of your unit, going into your elevator, down to the garage and into your car, then the opportunity for you to actually meet people on your street, meet people in your neighborhood, or in your building lobby, the likelihood goes down. So the neighborhood design has a part of it, building design has a part of it, and things like access to amenity spaces, access to, you know, green spaces, all play different roles into the piece. It's not really one piece, and some things have more impact than others, but it all comes together in different ways to create the environment that makes social relationships more likely to happen.
A mosque on the corner.
A mosque in the corner.
A grocery store within walking distance. A streetcar line.
Perhaps.
So we've done it before.
We have done it before.
Hear the result. Do you think we can, or are we, finding our way back to that?
I think we're finding our ways back to it. The people are understanding the value of walkability, being able to walk to places in your neighborhood, understanding the value of having a main street, a focal identity, a focal central gathering place in each neighborhood, the value of having transitionary spaces where you don't have to interact, but you can interact a little bit. But the problem that I think is happening now is how many people have access to that. When you look at the homes that are most affordable, the homes that, you know, are easier to access, they tend not to be the ones that have great design. The ones that are the most well designed, they're poorer people are being pushed out further and further away into longer commutes, and you know, the crisis of affordability and inclusion that's happening and we're seeing here in Vancouver is I think a testament to that, you know, good design exists, but it's not being accessed by everyone.
Those streetcar neighborhoods, Vancouver style, were all initially single family neighborhoods. And then over time, secondary suite, sometimes divided up, maybe now a small condo. But the fabric and the texture and the scale, in many cases that's intact from Grandview Woodland to West Point Grey. Now, because of affordability, the issues you've raised, what should we do with that? All that beautiful streetcar accommodation that we price up into the millions.
I think it's a combination of making sure that the investments that we have now are made accessible to a wider portion of people, a wider proportion of different demographics, but also that these investments happen in more places. So, you know, it's not just about making, you know, always investing more and more and more and more in a neighborhood like Kitsilano, but it's expanding the transit service, the walkability, the great lifestyle that you can get in a neighborhood like Kitsilano to other neighborhoods so that the supply of well-designed neighborhood increases. Now that you know, some people think that, you know, when you design a walkable community, the complete communities, tend to be more expensive. I think there's just not enough of them. If we are building complete communities with the same scale, with the same speed that we're building suburban communities, like, you know, not suburban, but car-dependent communities, then they would not necessarily be as expensive.
But what we're really good at is building regional centers, certainly walkable, but transit-oriented communities like Metrotown, Brentwood, Lougheed.
I am not as familiar with those as a Vancouverite would be. But
well, you see the towers on the skyline.
Yes, yes.
That's them.
Yes.
How do you feel about that? That's our version.
Well, I think it's a piece of it. But beyond the SkyTrain, beyond the density around the SkyTrain, are you going from 40 stories, very good access to the SkyTrain, and then you move a little bit further away from the SkyTrain line, what are these neighborhoods like?
They're those incredibly valuable single-family neighborhoods. That's a misnomer. They're probably not single-family, but they look like they are. Mm-hmm. And apparently people really value that.
And what kinds of people? Who can access them?
Oh, that was the Canadian dream.
Yeah.
At about the time when you came here just before, that was it.
That was it.
We love that stuff. And where our cities are affordable, they're producing more of it. And I'm wondering, you grew up in an environment that it sounds like you think would be perfect for us. The fourth story, extended family, small apartment building, on a walkable street, with a real diversity, and all the services.
I think it's four floors and corner stores. It's the idea of the missing middle housing, where we are finding that is, you know, the compromise between having the semi-private spaces, having the enough density to sustain transit, to sustain businesses, and the proximity to other people, while maintaining our human needs for privacy, for, you know, just having our own individual spaces.
Hassan, this might be... You can tell me if I'm going a little far here, but it does seem to me that you grew up in what you feel is a almost, if not idyllic, it was a place that made you happy. And then you had a sense of loss.
It made me happy, and the loss actually didn't happen when I moved to Canada. It happened gradually as these neighborhoods changed over my lifetime when I lived there. They changed since I left it. My four-story home, because of the real estate pressures, is now an eight-story home, believe it or not. And the little park that used to be next to my house was actually sold off and is now another building. And right now, I walk through my neighborhood that I have very fond memories of, and it looks nothing like it was.
Huh. You think you can do something in Canada that can bring back a sense of that? Is this the place?
I think, you know, Vancouver is a... It's seen as sort of a beacon for excellence in planning and design around the world. I mean, as a Vancouver-based company, people aspire to learn from us. It benefits us that we're based in Vancouver and we go internationally. It doesn't mean that everything is perfect in Vancouver, but I think that Vancouver is in a place where it can take really bold directions, really bold statements in the way that we design our cities, and absolutely be global leaders in creating happier, healthier, and more inclusive communities.
I think I see the connection. If we do establish that global reputation, and you're one of the people in Happy City who make it happen, maybe you can go back to Cairo and make it happen there again.
That's a story for another podcast.
I think it would make you very happy.
Of course. I studied urban planning to one day go back and serve my country, my people, help them. If I think the best thing that I can do to help Egyptians and Egypt is actually to do this work at this, at the level of excellence that is Vancouver, learning from people like you, all the other colleagues that I look up to as mentors, and soaking up all that experience and taking as much as I can back to Cairo.
Well, here's the thing, Hassam. You have already found out that we are a rather formal people, and yes, you need an invitation just to come and hang. Yeah, we're like that. On the other hand, we brought you into our tribe, and now in a ways we're part of Hassam's tribe.
Absolutely. And you're always welcome to join my tribe in Halifax, join my tribe in Cairo, and see how different worlds live.
I would so love to do that.
Absolutely.
And then we'll come back and talk about it.
Yes.
Thanks, Hassam.
Thank you so much, Gordon. It's a pleasure to be here.